Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kessner.
And this is Claire Kaplan. As we always do before our podcast begins, I want to remind our listeners that sometimes what we talk about in the podcast can be difficult to hear. So we encourage anyone, especially survivors of trauma, to care for your safety and well-being. Please reach out for emotional support from family or friends, a counselor if you have one, or a hotline. Additional resources can be found on the Take Back the Night Foundation website, and we'll share that address with you at the end of the podcast.
Thanks so much, Claire. And today's guest is not a survivor, but an amazing supporter, an author, and an activist, and I think in his own right. And we are delighted to have with us Michael Emberger. So Michael, we always love to hear a little bit about your bio, your background, where you grew up, anything you'd like to share with our listeners.
Sure. I'm an author. I went to Messiah College for engineering way back in the day, where I met my wife racing solar cars, actually, and then worked in engineering for a while and eventually got into advocacy on sexual assault and survivors and things like that.
Amazing. Amazing. So Messiah was in what decade? Like, was that 20 years ago for you?
Or? About. I graduated 2003.
Lovely. And then you stayed with engineering, and are you now a full-time author?
I wish. No, I still work full-time and just do this on the side.
Amazing. Okay. So how did this journey to advocacy come about? Was there a catalyst? And for those of our listeners who don't know, Messiah is a Christian college, a faith-based college in Pennsylvania. It's got a beautiful chapel. I've even lectured there myself a few times. So, Michael, I know exactly where you went to college. So,
oh, great, great.
Yep. And so what brought you to your advocacy?
So several years ago, a friend of mine suggested I join Twitter for the writing community there. And I did. And one of the first people to follow me was this woman I didn't know at all, Jillian. And I looked at her profile. I saw she had this essay she'd posted about being a survivor and trauma and how it affected her. And I thought that was really sad. And it wasn't something I was very familiar with. So I reached out to her. I sent her a message with trying to be some supportive words and such, and told her about Jesus a little bit. She got back to me. We got to talking. It turns out she's the founder and editor of a Medium publication called Fearless She Wrote, which is a survivor publication that had about 20,000 followers, I guess, at its peak. And we just started talking, got to know her more. Her trauma just broke my heart. And God put it on my heart to do something to try to raise my voice and help contribute to the conversation. So eventually I started writing some pieces on Medium, on Fearless. I read tons of things that other survivors wrote there. And then eventually I wrote Believed, which was my novel, to kind of advocate and share my heart on the matter.
And what was the goal of writing the book? Were you wanting to say, I'm a man? Like, in a nutshell, what would you say the book is about and the message you want the readers to get from it?
Sure. It's a book about a mermaid in college in Minnesota who goes through an experience of rape and not being believed and a whole legal battle and everything. And really, I wanted to show that as a man who hasn't gone through this, you know, to the extent that I can, I understand, I see what this is like, and just trying to help survivors feel seen and heard and encouraged. And also for anyone else that reads it, to raise some awareness and have them think about these issues more.
Wow. And can you summarize, is it, what's the setting? What's the perspective of the book? Tell us the synopsis.
Sure. Well, it's set in Minnesota in a fictional little town called Swordfish Lake. And in the world of this book, mermaids have left the oceans. They live with people on land, and they have all kinds of challenges with that. But at this college where Kelsey, the main character, goes, there's this guy, Chad Anderson, who is actually a descendant, fictional descendant of the author Hans Christian Andersen, who wrote The Little Mermaid. But, you know, he develops an interest in her, ultimately rapes her, and then she has to go through the whole process with the police and the lawyers and the judges and a court trial and, you know, facing a lot of people not believing her, not supporting her, and just trying to highlight all the different types of things that I've heard from survivors, how they deal with trauma, how they process these things, what society's like, and how we react to them.
And when was the book published? When was it released?
I believe that was 2021 or so. It was a couple of years ago.
So not too long ago. So what has been what has been the response to your book?
It's been really good. I have the book is available free actually on audiobook and on an audiobook that I had professionally recorded. And it's probably reached a few thousand people at least. I don't have the whole number, but I've gotten lots of good responses. Survivors telling me, you know, I felt seen by this. I felt heard. This was amazing. A couple people here and there comment that they didn't understand something, like how can mermaids walk on their fins standing up very slowly. But, you know, that's their whole response to the book. And I don't really know what to make of that. But the survivors I hear from occasionally, or that I see the reviews pop up, it can sometimes just melt my heart to see what it meant to them.
So how has that response impacted you now? Has it changed anything at all for you?
I would say, if you're familiar with Diane Langberg, she's a psychologist that deals with trauma and survivors. She wrote a book in which she talked about how survivors, when you ally yourself to them, when you kind of work in this space of support, they can be an incredible blessing. And that's what I have found to be true all throughout this, through writing, through getting to know survivors as an ally, through how I see them respond to the book. It's just a blessing. And it makes me feel even more that I just need to do this. I need to raise my voice when I see so few men doing that. So it encourages me. It makes me want to keep going and try to help.
And what about other men? Have you heard from them?
Occasionally. For the most part, I don't see that many men involved in the spaces that I write in or that I read things from. They tend to be the trolls that are giving the survivors a hard time. And it's really not that many that I see getting involved. But a few friends of mine who've read it or such, they've been supportive and they like the content. But I wish there were more.
Katie, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I was thinking, Michael, can you share with us also, you know, Claire just said, how has it impacted you personally? But I think it's pretty huge just to randomly take on one woman you meet on Twitter. Yeah. And write a whole book about it. You know, was there anything else you think in your life story that made you so willing to take on someone else's cause as your own to try and make a difference? Like, what do you attribute that to?
When I reached out to her, I had recently written a different book that was unrelated, but I had something in the author's notes that kind of talked about the trials women go through just day to day in life and the hardships and unfairness. And so I talked a little bit about that with her. So it's something that's always kind of been on my heart before that. You know, I try to write with female main characters that are strong, that do important things, that, you know, take risks and make sacrifices. So going back a long time, I guess I had the mindset for that. And then once I met Jillian, it just broke my heart, and I couldn't not do something about it. And so the more that I wrote, the more that I get involved, I just kept going.
Beyond the book, then, what else are you doing to stay an activist and involved?
I post things here and there on social media, but probably the bulk of what I do is just the individual relationships with survivors, trying to be an ally to them. I do a lot of writing correspondence back and forth with a number of them.
What is the context of the writing correspondence?
It really varies. Some survivors I've met through the books, like asking for test readers. I'll reach out to some, and over time, you know, I get to know them. We get to talking. I become an ally. Others I'll meet online, maybe through like Sexual Assault Awareness Month in April. Some of them post on there. I'll message some occasionally, and those relationships can continue. So just various places that's drawn from. But those who are interested in having that ongoing conversation, it can really be a good thing where I offer support, encouragement, you know, whatever I can, answering their questions and such.
What about I guess I'll go to another direction is, what do you think? I mean, most rapists are men, most men are not rapists, but what do you think it is about men? Is it biology? Is it attitude? Is it how you're raised? You have a wife and you have children?
Yes.
Yeah,
a wife, four kids.
Do you have any sons?
Two sons, two daughters.
So tell me about what your thoughts are on, you know, how do we end or change rape culture, and what do we need to do with our next generation of young men, including your sons?
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously that's a huge question. But I think, you know, there's the attitude, the societal attitudes we have, how men are brought up with the, you know, the macho thing and the, you know, you're cool if you can get with as many women as you can, all those types of things. The things that the media portrays as far as, you know, sexist types of portrayals of women all the time, just makes you think that way about them. Even the church and Christianity, the teachings that some churches, some denominations hold that are really, really negative towards women, as kind of second and less and just there for the benefit of men. It's, you know, there's a million reasons why it's a problem, I think.
Yeah. And how do we start to change the attitudes? You know, if you could do it your way, what would we do differently in how we're raising our next generation of men?
Well, I think we would have a lot more men speaking up and engaged on it. And really, I think awareness is probably one of the biggest problems. Speaking for myself, coming in from not having seen so much of that, like before I met Jillian, I could name maybe one or two people that I knew of who had gone through something like this. And then after that, it's like this whole world opens up. If you're looking for it, you see survivors advocating everywhere. You see all these things, but it's very easy for men otherwise to just be unaware of that and kind of leave that bubble alone and see the occasional news headline about, you know, something, some trial, but otherwise just ignore it. So I think somehow we need to get that message out beyond the bubble and to men everywhere and get them actually talking about it.
Yeah,
I think you raise a really important point, and that is, until it actually enters your bubble, as you say, or sphere directly, it's almost like it's sort of way out there somewhere, and you don't really have to think about it, right? And mm-hmm. especially because most men don't think they are potential victims, right? Even though that's not really true, but that's what most men are raised to think. So it's sort of a problem for other people. I think you're right. Until it affects you directly, it doesn't seem to be all that big of a deal, all that important. So I'm curious because you, two things that crossed my mind. One is the recent, I wonder what you thought of the recent revelations I think the Southern Baptist Convention where mm-hmm. all, you know, the people were abusing people and then there was all this chaos that went on, you know, conflict, what your thoughts are about that kind of institutional response. And the other piece is the trolls that you mentioned. Have you ever tried to engage any of those people in any kind of conversation?
Okay. Sure. The Southern Baptist thing, I've kind of watched that over the last year or more, following people on social media who share a lot of news about that and opinions. And to me, it seems like at every step, they've pretty much made the wrong decisions about how to process and handle that, really to try to silence survivors, to just minimize the problem, make it go away, keep the same guys in charge with, you know, minimal rehabilitation, as far as they probably would call it. But it's a huge issue. And I think it just demonstrates how many men don't think this is serious at all. They think it's a joke, you know, just a nuisance that they can ignore until it goes away. And then they carry on business as usual. And as far as the trolls, there were times back on Medium when Fearless was still active, I saw some of those. There were a couple that that I did engage with a little bit. One actually questioned something I had written, and so I had a bit of a conversation with him, and that ended up pretty reasonable. But it's been surprising to me how sometimes the people that you most expect would support you are the ones that don't. Like reaching out sometimes to fellow Christians online on things. Like I challenged something once put up by a satire piece, page on Facebook, I think, and a bunch of Christians just took a lot of issue like that, calling me, you know, you're woke and you're, you know, with all this ridiculous liberal stuff with, you know, the feminism and everything. And so that's just really disheartening to see that from people that should care.
Yeah. What do you think, Michael, we can do about that? Because, you know, that was part of my big part of my journey. I don't know if you read my story, but I was raised to wait till I was married. I was, you know, went to church 3 times a week, probably. And when this happened to me and I lost my virginity, the first place I was going to go was my church. Like in the dark of night, I was like, I need to talk to God about what happened. And then the hard thing was, you know, people at my church were like, well, you had him over to your room, or, you know, there was a lot of victim blaming coming from the church. And that was really hard. You know, I thought I was a good Christian. And then my community, you know, turned their backs on me. So what can we do to help, you know, the Christian community understand that victims deserve respect and not blame? What do you think we can do?
There was a missionary actually that contacted me a while ago, and this was from another country, where she did some work surveying pastors and ministers about, you know, what do they preach on these issues? What do they talk about? And the overwhelming response was nothing, because they just didn't know what to say. They didn't know how to handle it, so they ignored it. And, you know, I'd have to say within my experience through different churches and growing up, it's just hardly talked about other than maybe wait until marriage and things like that. We don't talk about, you know, trauma and what types of things this does to people and how we need to support them. So I think making it a bigger part of the conversation and getting people to realize how much trauma hurts. It's not just this thing that happened that one day or night and they get over it by, you know, 24 hours later, that, you know, these people need support for years. They need care. They need love. They need Jesus and grace and everything that survivors need to heal. And the church is so well positioned to provide that. But instead you get, you know, the victim blaming and the negative attitudes and things that probably come from a lot of doctrines that people have grown up with. But spreading the message and just trying to reach out, and hopefully more people doing that would have an effect over time.
Yeah, I hope so. I really hope so. I mean, a faith should be a place where you can find comfort and support. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. when it's not a safe place, it's very alienating, especially if you thought, you know, like me, that you, for 18 years, I thought that was a safe place. So I'm glad we were talking about that on the podcast today, Michael. Claire, did you want to follow up?
Well, yeah, and what you said really resonated. I think part of the issue, and this is not only in terms of religions or faiths, but also if someone feels ill-equipped or doesn't know about an issue, the tendency is to be silent about it, right? It's like when just sexual harassment, for example, in the workplace, when the companies or businesses don't have any policies or don't do anything, it's because they're thinking, I don't know what to do about it, right? They don't try to do the work to figure out what they can do. And I think that given most organized religions, it's sort of, you know, given perspectives on women or on gender and sex, the first response is, if I don't talk about it, it's going to go away, right? That's part of the issue.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it doesn't. So, I mean, you can understand how it's been a difficult road for many organizations to come to the place where they can actually address it, because it also challenges a whole lot of long-held beliefs that aren't necessarily rooted in the faith itself. But I, it's interesting that you're doing this work, because I feel like men like you can actually have an impact in your particular practice of Christianity, that you could have an impact on how your colleagues talk about it, how they see it, how they, you know, work on the issue. And I really am impressed by how you're persisting in this. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah. And one of the things is just, you know, the awareness of how prevalent this is.
Yes.
You'll get Christians who say, no, those statistics are made up. It's fake news and such. And just a quick example, I was talking to a husband once of a survivor who really didn't have any clue what she was going to through and thought, you know, that happened in her past. It's over. And I was kind of talking with him and realizing, you know, this guy doesn't have any sense of trauma and what she probably needs from him and why, you know, she might be having some of the issues she was. So that lack of awareness is a huge problem.
Yeah, I agree with you, Claire. You know, Michael, the work you're doing is, it's imperative, and you're able to talk in a neighborhood. I'll say that a lot of silence and shame still exists. And I would say it's true in a lot of faiths beyond Christianity. You know,
right.
We're doing global work, and unfortunately, a lot of our world religions are very patriarchal. And I think it's really critical that we start to examine who had the writing instruments in their hands when all these faith books were written. And what, you know, it was men. Women weren't, you know, that wasn't a thing we were allowed to do at that point in history in any part of the world for any book of faith. And so I'm really in admiration of the work you're doing. But a mantra I always say is like, you can't argue with God. And so I'm, as an activist myself, it's a very delicate walk to talk about challenging words on a page that allegedly are direct words from God. And my faith says somebody wrote those down and it wasn't exactly God. but you know, I think it is really important, I don't know that we can change God. That's my, and I, it's a, I'm not saying God, but I'm not sure we can change enough of those who, I mean, God to me represents holding fast to a tenet of why are we on this earth and what will happen when we leave this earth. And those are the two of the most, and then what should we do while we're on the earth? It's like how we got here, what are we supposed to do, and what's going to happen when we leave? And that, those are big life questions that faith provides some answers to around the world, you know, different books. And so I feel overwhelmed. I'm glad you're not overwhelmed, but I feel very overwhelmed because it's different than changing. Like I testified on Capitol Hill for federal laws that passed and changed actions and behaviors. Like they forced change for institutions and humans, individuals. And I'm a big question on today's episode is something I think I'm struggling with, and I'm really glad to struggle with you because it's such an important big question. And I don't know where to go with the faith part except to move it very gently. I mean, I'm trying to think how you've had a long faith journey, Michael. You know, Messiah, I having stood in the chapel giving a speech there on this topic was huge 20 years ago. I hope you might have been in my audience. I'm just saying, like, the chapel was required at Messiah, and I think once a week or twice a week, I forget.
Yeah.
But I was one of the guest speakers for one of your chapel sessions. And I've always tried to, when I've spoken at Baptist colleges or Christian colleges or Presbyterian, you know, all the different Episcopalian, like, I always try to find something in the book. I'll say the book. Sometimes I'll be at a Jewish school, you know, the book that will resonate with my audience. And there are lots of good biblical stories about, you know, how God treats women. Or how we should treat women who have had challenging life courses, or infidelity, and men. So there are some strong narratives, but I feel like they're not often the ones we highlight or talk about. What do you think about that?
I think, when you look at the Bible and such, there's certainly different interpretations of it, and the patriarchal types and everything look to what did Paul write? Women should be silent in church, and they just want to make that universal. I've heard over my lifetime enough sermons, enough commentaries, enough, descriptions of how and why we understand that in the original text and context and everything to know that it's not as clear-cut as people make it out to be in the churches where they say this is just black and white issue. We're supposed to read the Bible as a whole and look at it through a lens of Jesus and the example he gave, what he did, how he interacted with people. And in my view, how Jesus approached women was with equality, with love, with understanding, treating them extremely well. So that's how I view the Bible. Looking at all these churches that don't, I think, they're really going down the wrong course, looking more for political power, for just keeping the influence of men and everything. And that's a big mess, and it's going to take a long time. But, we do see occasionally some who change their mind, who say, hey, I was wrong, I apologize for that, and that's kind of nice to see. But I also have a new book I just put out. It's called Dear Survivor.
Oh,
and
nice.
It's kind of a letter. Oh. Yeah, it's a letter from my heart to survivors. And I go through a lot of things about, what does Jesus have to say to you? What does he think of you? How much does he support and love you? And it talks a little bit about some of the things that he did on earth and with survivors. But just trying to affirm and lift these women up as, daughters of God, as daughters of the King, just worthy of honor, worthy of respect, and not the way that they're being treated by so many people today.
It's interesting, Katie, how you mentioned you can't argue with God. And given that I come from a totally different faith tradition, you're supposed to argue with God. So Jews are always arguing with God. I think that's what the whole Talmud is. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to hear this perspective where you sort of have to accept a certain amount of this as just that's it. And then you kind of go from there. Coming from a very arguing family, I think that this has been interesting for me to hear this. Yeah. And I think it's wonderful that you've written this new book. I think that there has to be a way that it can be promoted in a way, I imagine that are faith-based publishers interested in your work, or how do you get it out?
These books I have self-published because I put them out for free, mm-hmm. Just trying to get them out to anyone I can. There's a lot of limitations working with an actual publisher.
Yeah.
I've done that in the past for fictional novels, and you're just kind of stuck with other people making decisions and doing things and charging way too much for it. So
that's true.
I wanted to do this my way. The audiobook of Believed, which is completely free on all kinds of platforms, mm-hmm. That's reaching people far better than I could have trying to go with a publisher, I think, because they see it there, on the top of the list of results. I don't have to pay for this, so they try it.
Right, right. Katie?
Yeah, I'm thinking about anything else, Michael, to talk with you about, because I'm so excited about what you're doing and the inroads you're making. At one point, we even talked about on the podcast doing an offshoot with our authors and doing a book club. We never got it going because we didn't have... I didn't have the bandwidth to do it, but maybe if our listeners are listening to this and they have interest, they might reach out to us, because Michael, you might be a cool person to lead that discussion group. You're like Mr. Help. I mean, I can't believe how much generosity you have and just online support and conversations with survivors. It's really exciting and empowering to hear that a man, of your, I'm not going to say you're old, but you're like, he's not old. He's way younger than I am. But
yeah, 42. Yeah, 42.
You're in your 40s, Michael?
Yeah, 42.
Yeah. So I just think it's exciting. It's exciting that you have taken this on, and you have two sons that you can raise to walk in your footsteps and, in your faith footsteps. So hopefully they will learn from how much good you're doing in the world, listen to this episode, and be proud of their father for being such a strong male role model on such an issue that affects 1 in 4 women and 1 in 6 men, in the United States. Those are our statistics. So It's exciting and an honor to host you, Michael. I'm really grateful, and I'm sure listening will be helpful to a lot of our survivors. So thank you for joining us. Claire, do you want to ask anything else?
I don't have any other questions.
Yeah. What a fantastic conversation, Michael. Is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners?
I think just for any survivor listening, you know, first, I'm sorry that you've gone through what you have and how hard that is. But I hope maybe the encouragement you can take from listening to this is that one survivor can make a huge difference in the world, just in interacting with people and sharing if she chooses to. You know, she can change somebody's heart and kind of put them on a life mission that you never would have expected.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again. Claire, can you close out for our listeners?
Absolutely. So thank you again, Michael, for joining us and sharing your work with us. I'm sure and I hope, but I'm certainly certain that you will be inspiring other people to respond in some positive way. And also thank you to our wonderful volunteers who make this podcast possible. They do all the work that brings it to you, the listener. And thank you to the listeners who are here to hear the story told today and want to learn. Help us help other survivors. Subscribe to this podcast and share it far and wide on your social media. And please follow us on our Facebook and Instagram pages. If you need support but don't know where to find it, visit takebackthenight.org for a list of resources and also how to reach our legal support hotline. And remember, self-care is essential to healing and to thriving.
Thanks so much, Claire. And again, thank you so much, Michael. And for all of our listeners, remember to, you know, keep following us, keep listening, take it 1 minute at a time, 1 day at a time, 1 hour at a time. It's a process and it's not always linear. And together we will shatter the silence and end the violence. Thank you.